If you want to be at the tip of the spear of sports performance, the answer is simple. Simply Faster is your insider's edge to maximize results with the highest quality premier sports equipment in the business. Visit Simply Faster and level up. Welcome everyone to the Companions of the Compendium podcast. We're taking a little bit of a different direction from our usual runners, and we're moving into the world of jumps. Today I have with me Coach Chamoff, who is the Mizzou coach extraordinaire, who just got finished with an amazing indoor meet with four different jumpers reaching All-American status, which brings his total up to 27 All-Americans, eight conference champions, and he's done this at three different universities in his time. He's spent time at Lindenwood, SIU Edwardsville, and at the University of Missouri. And those of us who can't see on film, I'm rocking my Mizzou shirt. I've been a big fan of Mizzou for a really long time as a St. Louis resident and a good friend with the head coach, Brett Halter. So it's an absolute pleasure to have the jump master, Coach Chamoff, on with me today. Coach, how you doing?
I'm pretty good. Hi, Ryan. Thank you very much for the invitation. It's a real pleasure for me being here with you.
Absolutely. Well, I'm looking forward to it. It's what's so great about having a podcast and having a decent network of friends in the sport. I get to have cool conversations with experts like you, and I get to learn alongside with the audience about maybe an event that admittedly isn't my strength per se, but hopefully you'll level me up as a coach today and all the listeners as well.
Happy to be here.
Talk to the audience. Tell us a little bit about your story, where you came from, how you got involved in track and field, and specifically the love of jumps, bringing you to the point where you're at now, and maybe some of the mentors you had along the way through that process.
Yeah, the journey started very long time ago. I was born and raised at the track. My mother is a track and field coach, and actually I'm third generation coach right now. And my first memories growing up as a child is like not even on the playground. So I'm at the sand pit making a meatballs with the sand and like watching track and field meets every single weekend. And that's how I started with the track. Realistically, I didn't want to coach at some point of my life. I wanted to be involved with sport, but I didn't want to continue my professional career for the rest of my life with coaching. It just happened that once you have the love about it, like you cannot escape of it. And, you know, it became like a destiny for me.
So what was the big moment in that process that kind of changed your mind on getting involved? Like when did you know, okay, I've been really reluctant to be a coach, but there's no escaping it. And here's why there's no escaping it. What was that moment that really kind of made it clear for you that this was going to be a career for the rest of your life?
You know, I was doing track in high school and college as well. I was blessed to grow up around Olympic champions and world champions, even world record holders. So being in that environment every day became like a normal environment for me. I wasn't like, wow, this person is a world champion, or wow, this person is Olympic champion. So that was a normal people for me, just like the way now I'm seeing all my friends, that was the surrounding environment. And when I stopped with track and field, I was definitely wanted to stay in the world of sport, and I pursued my degree in physical therapy. Wanted to spend more time in the rehab and being around athletes, but not necessarily coaching. Just helping the athletes to become their best version in a little bit different perspective. After my physical therapy degree in Bulgaria, I came to United States just to continue a little bit longer with my education. I just wanted to be better in what I do. And I started studying athletic training at Lindenwood, as you mentioned earlier. At that time, the Lindenwood track and field wasn't blessed with coaches. It was a lot of turnover. You know, one coach is coming, another coach is leaving. And I saw so many talented athletes on the team that really needed a little bit of guidance, a little bit of coaching. And my initial idea was I will do that while I'm doing my degree, but not necessarily as a life destiny path to do. That's how I start coaching. I just start coaching and helping the team. At first as a volunteer coach, and after that I became a graduate assistant. But my idea was just a couple years, 3 years, just to help the athletes on the team, you know, compete a little bit better and practice more consistently. And after that, it's been every day since then.
So do you feel like your background in physical therapy informed you in the combination with your athletic experience and then your academic experience? Do you think that that really raised your level as a coach to be able to provide better systems, training, and care to those athletes?
Absolutely. This is one of the things that I believe made me who I am today as a coach. Just the deep knowledge of the human body, of how the physiology of the human works. After that, taking my athletic training degree, now rehabbing and recovering the human body helped me a lot. And in addition to that, I was blessed working with one of the best professors, probably in the world, Dr. Schroeder. She was my leading professor at Lindenwood for my master's degree in human performance. And she's very well known in the world of research. She was actually one of the first people doing research on creatine over NBA players and NFL players. Working with her hand-to-hand in my master's degree just opened my mind so much towards performance in general over sport.
Now, this is a small world, Coach, because Dr. Schroeder, I did take a couple classes as well at Lindenwood for the Human Performance Masters, and I had an opportunity actually to then move to the Mizzou Positive Coaching Psychology Program. But actually, not only did I have Dr. Schroeder as a professor, but she was, before she became this world-renowned professor, she got her start as a PT person, and she was actually our PT person at my high school.
Wow, yeah.
So really, it's cool. Crazy small world, right? So what were some of the things that you wanted to do right away? Obviously, you mentioned consistency, but what were some of the things that you wanted to provide those athletes at Lindenwood that you felt like they weren't getting?
Really, truly, like, simple of coaching. Like, I wasn't looking for huge performances or, like, being national champions or stuff like that. I was just looking, when we go to the stadium, to the track, I wanted the athletes to have a coach who can time them at sprint, running, who can give a little bit of guidance. And my real goal was for them to feel more comfortable day-to-day practices and hopefully perform a little bit better at national championship when they go there.
So with that and understanding your situation and what you were trying to do, you mentioned your experience by spending a lot of time around Olympic champions, world record holders. What did those early experiences do for you to kind of understand the world of sport? And were those world champions in the jumps? Were they in other events? Were they in the multi events? But what did they provide you as a young person in terms of an understanding of the overall sport of track and field?
As a kid, I didn't realize how much this means to be around these people. And I was taking it just like normal everyday environment. And a little bit by little bit, I've seen like, okay, this person is going to world championships and does so well, but at the end of the day, he's just a normal person. And I was thinking like, if, every person works his heart, if every person is dedicated to what he does, can achieve very big performances, can become very famous and very popular in what they do in their respective areas. So it really showed me how it doesn't take magic. It doesn't take extraordinary abilities to be at that level. It's really hard work and it's just love to what you do. That's it.
So you mentioned that you're a third generation coach. Was your mom and then the other relatives in that line of coaches, were they some of your biggest mentors or did that come along later?
My grandfather, he coached a little bit. He coached soccer, not specifically track and field. My mother is a track and field coach. And my father also has been a national level athlete for track and field and involved with the sport, but not coaching at all at the moment. So definitely my mother built me in my high school years as an athlete I was and really gave me strong fundamental knowledge of what sport has to be as a habits, everyday activity, as just the culture of the sport. She built that in me, showed me how high level achievements are, as I said earlier, accessible to everybody as long as you work hard. Unfortunately for me, the love was jumps. And the reason I chose jumps is I was not a gifted athlete. I wasn't blessed with speed. I wasn't blessed with strength or any other qualities, neither in our jumping abilities. And the reason why I chose jumping is because the approaches was the shortest of the runs on the track. And that's how I started with the jumps. My mother is a specialist in the 400 and 800 meters. And that was also a new area for her. But as I say, she built a great fundamentals for me. After graduating high school, I had to move to a different city to pursue my physical therapy degree. And I chose to be with one of the best jumps coaches in the world. His name is Marin Donchev, and he's the second biggest influence in my my track world and in my life in general. He was the assistant coach of Hristo Markov, who was Olympic champion and Olympic gold medalist in the triple jump. He came pretty close to 18 meters, and he was assistant coach for him. So great coach, multiple people at world championship, Olympic games, Diamond League champion. He made an athlete actually who made Jonathan Edwards cry in 98. So it was fun growing and being around these athletes, but he was my coach in college in Bulgaria. These are two people with a huge, very strong influence in my life.
Now, if you were going to take a perfect world and take the strengths of what you experienced in Europe and the strengths of what you've experienced in America, what are the strengths and weaknesses between the two systems? Compare and contrast those two experiences versus the Bulgarian experience, in which, by the way, for those who are not really in a depth of knowledge of European track and field, Bulgaria always does better than this per capita of a country. They are, you obviously could speak more of this than I can, but very, very interested in track and field and have achieved a lot of great things through the sport. And one of those countries that I always look to and always with interest because there's so many good athletes coming out of there, especially like, female sprinters and all sorts of stuff. So, but anyway, tell us a little bit about the strengths and weaknesses of your experience in Bulgaria and your experience in America. Do a little compare and contrast for us.
First, I'm very happy that you mentioned that per capita, how many. Bulgaria is a very small country. It's approximately the size of Missouri, if not smaller. You know, we've been blessed with a lot of achievements at Olympic stages and world stages. If you look at the total map, it's going to say, okay, one or two medals, no big deal. But considering it's the size of Missouri, I think it's pretty impressive for number of population. Two completely different worlds, I gotta say, day and night. But probably if I can like sum up everything, it's like, it's complicated. You cannot like put a sum up on stuff like that, but like everything starts with a lot of like technicalities in Bulgaria. Like, you know, kids concentrate a lot on the technical aspect of the events. Here is popular how everybody are multi-sport athletes and do multiple sports. This is very rare back home. You know, you cannot see that somebody's doing soccer and track and volleyball at the same time. It's exactly the opposite. Kids specialize early. When I say specialize, doesn't mean you're doing a triple jump or a long jump or pull vault, but you specialize in the sport. You're a track athlete and you know that you're a track athlete and that's what you do. Once that starts, it's a lot of drills, a lot of technical drills. Nobody is looking in the early age, let's say like 12, 13, 14, 15 years old for specific results. Most of what I experienced through my time there was like coaches are trying to build strong base in you. They're trying to teach you how to move, how to do a lot of sprint drills properly, how to do boundings, how to even catch the bar, you know, and start moving the Olympic lifts at early age. My first experience with Olympic lift was at for age of 14. I didn't lift heavy and I wasn't able to. I was so, as I say, untalented kid. All girls were beating me in the weight room. But, you know, the knowledge of that's how is the grip for the bar, that's what the motion is, start very early. So once I moved to, you know, high school age years, everything was like comfortable and known to me how to do it. And then coaches start looking for more specific results in the events you specialize. You know, the difference here I see is like, I coach just a little bit in high school here, spend about a season. It's, as I say, multi-sports, which develops a lot of the coordination, a lot of the athleticism with our kids. I think it loses a little bit of the specific of the events on long term. Put bigger burden on the college coaches. Now we got to start learn how to do Olympic lifts. Now we have to start learn how to do proper high knee. I see a lot of running here, a lot of running. Sprint, speed, running, speed endurance. That's a big thing for United States, what I see through my own experiences from high school level, NAI level, smaller Division One, and now in a bigger Division One school, a lot of run, a lot of speed endurance, a lot of sprints. And that's what United States is famous with sprints and jumps. So in the track and field world, back home is more oriented in techniques, strength, and plyometrics, if I say so.
And so your mom kind of lived that as well, in terms of, hey, hard work, the technical aspects of the event. You don't have to be a freaky athlete. You can get to world-class performances if you're able to do all of these things that you had mentioned, from Olympic lifting, biomechanics, the technical movements, the technical drills, and you can reach a high level through that process.
Correct. Everything is like present in the picture. Like there is no piece that is missing. So weightlifting and the strength, strong plyometrics. You know, as I say, she was a 400, 800 meter coach. You know, I run more than I had to do for jumps. I can admit that. And pretty much everything is present. There is another interesting piece. I say the huge difference between United States and here is like, in early ages, the multi-events is required. So when the kid is like 13, 14, 15, when I say multi, don't imagine a decathlon. You know, for a younger age, it's like a 3 or 4 events combination, and there's a multi-event. But all kids are required to go through it. If somebody want to do individual event at age of 14, you can do it, but you still got to do the multi-event competition. And like that, set up the base for each kid and each coach, that you can see really the strengths and weaknesses in the development of the athlete. And like that, it's easier, I believe, for coaches to specialize in the individual events afterward.
Yeah, we found that. I actually, in my PE, my middle school PE, so sixth, seventh, and eighth grade, I'm not in the middle school, I'm in the high school. But during their physical education, they've really helped me out by creating a track and field unit. So every kid, every one of those years does the long jump, shot put, high jump, 100, 200, 400, 800, and mile. And so at that point, I can go, okay, this person is gearing this way, or this person is here. And on top of it, it allows me to like go recruit those kids. I don't have to try to chase down 300 kids in a grade. I can go after 20. And I wish that more schools in America would do that, have a robust track and field experience, even if it's just a unit in their PE, so that way the kids can see what they're really good at. And then we as coaches could take that raw data and information. And then, like you said, later down the line, it's like, okay, it looks like you're probably going to go this direction. But it also, which is good for us for later, but for the development, it's good because it's giving the athletes a lot of different experiences, which I think make them a more strong athlete, a more robust athlete, an athlete that can survive future work because they've had all these experiences. Where if they have this really narrow athletic experience, you take one little false move in a different direction and they could get hurt. They could get broken, or they just don't have what I think is the athletic foundation to be really, really good down the line because they haven't seen those athletic experiences. Would you agree, Coach?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and one of the things that it bothers me a little bit, I don't think it's a wrong thing, but it bothers me internally. I feel like almost every single kid in high school level, it's a quarter mile runner. I mean, do we really have to run every single person in quarter mile? Like, I don't feel like 400 meters is fit for everybody. Yes, it requires the athleticism that all events go require now. Body structure, the length of the stride. This kid is tall. He can run like 400, 300 hurdles, you know, in high school or so on. But with same body size, you can do way more, many more events. And I think it has to be explored. Every single event has to be explored. And the end of the day, if it's not your event, hey, you did not lose anything. You built your track and field culture a little bit better.
I agree. And that's the thing that it was hard for me early on, Coach. I was one of those coaches that just everybody's a 400 meter runner and a sprinter. And that's all I cared about, you know. And then one of my assistant coaches, who's a mentor of mine as well, and she still is my assistant coach today, she said, hey, she goes, you're a little bit of a control freak. And I was like, whoa, you know. But then I sat back, I go, well, you're actually right. You know, and she said, look, we have a track and field team. We have to have field events. You have to put good athletes in these events, not just because we want to score points, but that could be their best event. And we don't want to limit their chances, you know, to go on into college and be very competitive if we don't do that. Now, full disclosure, Coach, we stink at the high jump, you know, so I'm hopefully going to learn something from you today about how to attack that. But in the horizontal jumps, the long jump, the triple jump, we've had a lot of success when we moved to that direction. And the same thing with the throws. You know, some of our best sprinters are even better throwers, you know, so we've put them in the discus. We've put them in the shot put. I think it's really important for coaches to know to do that, not just to say, it would be nice to do, but be intentional about it. You know, where we spend the first 2 weeks of our high school season having all of our kids try all of the events, even some of our returning kids, because maybe after that first year, they've watched it, they've seen it vicariously, and they're like, oh, that's how that's supposed to look. And then the next year they come out and it's like, oh, all of a sudden they can spin the discus. All of a sudden they can hit a second phase in the triple jump or do better at penultimate, you know, the penultimate step in the long or triple. So those are things that I think are really important for coaches to hear. Now, last thing about a mentor, and then we're going to move on to you and your training and your system. What did you get from Coach Donachev that you felt like has carried on with you, that you've learned from him as a lesson that you still implement with your athletes now?
Oh, wow. A lot. I mean, I can say a very big percentage of my coaching is pretty close to the way he coached. Absolutely a lot. You know, watching his success through the years, like, you know, athlete after athlete, and as they say, Olympic Games, World Championship, Diamond Leagues, that's another proof that the system worked. Of course, it's not 100% exactly how he does it, but I can say like big percentage of what I do is like, I took it from him. I took it from him, and I, for the technicalities maybe, is the strongest piece I have from him. He taught me a lot how, doesn't matter how athlete feel it today, you know, horrible practice feeling. He was saying that everybody can jump good when they feel good. How are you going to make it happen? And how are you going to make somebody jump okay, not good, when they're in their worst? And that's one of the things probably stick the most as a sentence, as a saying from him. But the eye for technicality, he has a different point of view that not a lot of people possess.
So with his eye, what was something that he kind of helped you focus on in terms of, let's watch this particular thing, and then how would he adjust it if it was a bad day to get something still good out of the worst day?
He wasn't like a very per se like strong in sports psychology, but the methods and the tools he was using, you know, are totally like sports psychology. So when we were jumping, for example, and his world level athletes are jumping as well, if somebody has a bad practice, his main goal was, I got to pull one good jump or one good motion. And the moment we do that, we can stop. Like that, first of all, we stop in a good note. But now the brain works like, I've done it when it's difficult. I've done it like the way it's supposed to be when I don't feel my best. And if you have a day like that at the meet, because, you know, we live in humans, like, you know, everybody can have a bad day at the meet, stomach virus or just long travel overseas with the airplane delays, and you have to compete on the next day. And he says, if you can do that at practice consistently, you'll be okay in any conditions at competitions.
With that being said, when you're looking at your practices, first general question with your system, how do you manage these three very different jump events at such a high level? You have coached all Americans in the triple, the long, and the high jump. How do you manage all of that? They're such different events. What are things that you do to get them to this high level?
At first, when I started coaching, I was doing the mistake that all jumpers gonna practice together. You know, it's a jumps, we're gonna do the practice together. And it was a huge mistake. I think probably the biggest mistake somebody can do as a jumps coach, putting the whole events practicing together. Once, twice a week, yes, there is interceptions in what we do. Weight room, yes, absolutely. The rest of the week, three different events, three different type of people. You know, we cannot coach high jumps the way we coach triple jump. We cannot coach long jump the way we coach in the high jump. Everything is different in terms of like sprint practices, pure sprint practices, plyometrics, weightlifting, even the same weight room weightlifting, they have different lifting exercises most of the time. So I started separating the groups. That's what really I think was the key for me. First of all, made my life easier, you know, in terms of volume, how many people we have at the same time. And I was able to pay better attention to details, one-on-one, what's happening with athletes at every given moment. And of course, the modalities of every practice are specifically designed for the event. I don't want to say that that's not a good thing, and I'm going to explain myself why. At the level I'm trying to bring my athletes currently, they have to be separate. If I'm coaching high school newbies, I can say, I totally can put them together and giving the explanations and the direction at the same time. But looking for high level results, NCAA national results or world level results, these three groups got to be separate, I believe.
So when you set up your week, and I know I've got a couple questions about this, but for this particular aspect, what's your usual rhythm of what group do you work with when? So I'm working with high jumpers on this day, work with long and triple on this day, or long then triple. Do you have a rhythm? And if you do, why do you have that rhythm? How does that fit into your overall plan?
I like simplicity. I think simplicity creates habits, and as a humans, we are very habitual creatures. So I'm trying to stick with pretty much the same structure through the weeks and the months. Of course, practices are changing, but what we do on Mondays, what we do on Tuesdays, what we do on Wednesdays, in terms of energy systems, they stay same. We jump in about twice a week, Tuesday and Thursday. It's always Tuesday and Thursday, our jumps. And yes, they come in different times of the day based on their class schedules. They know our jump sessions, like technical session or plyometric session, if it's early in the season, it's Tuesday and Thursday. So structure stays same. Like Mondays, we're doing like our short sprints, pure sprint workouts. Tuesday is a jump session. Wednesday depends on what part of the season we are. You know, can be a speed endurance or recovery day. Thursday is another jump session. And Friday, again, depends on what part of the season we are. We're hitting heavy plyometrics or speed endurance. Depends if it's early in the season or like close to competitions as well.
With the sprint sessions on a Monday, what traditionally, if you had your best workout that you wanted to do with those athletes on a Monday, how would that sprint workout look? How does it typically look? How's it constructed? What's your rest recovery ratios, repetition numbers, all that stuff? Like, go dive deep for me on that.
I'm going to start a little bit deeper before I go to your question, just to explain what I'm looking specifically into the whole training process. I'm a huge fan of the post-activation potentiation. It's like activating the nerve system before anything we do on the track. So we lift three times a week, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, in the weeks that we don't have competition, of course. Our first lift session is on Monday morning. So when we come back on the track in the morning, Monday afternoon, and I know a lot of coaches are going to jump out of their chairs right now. You do sprints after lifting? Yes, I do. I do, and I'm going to explain myself why, based on the human body, physiologically, neurologically, that's where I'm coming from. And now, yeah, are the athletes feel a little bit like off? Maybe. Are they feel not freshest? Maybe, but interesting, they do feel fresh. They feel more explosive after weightlifting in the morning. I mentioned earlier, Dr. Schroeder, she said that when I was going through my education with her, she said, if you don't learn post-activation potentiation, forget to be a world-level coach. You'll be a coach, everybody are coaches, but if you don't know post-activation potentiation, you're going to always be behind the peers that they know that. So that was another mind-opening for me. And I start experimenting, implementing, and realistically, when I start working this way, I realize, that's exactly how most of the coaches do it in Europe. It's not different. They just probably don't know the terminology of it, but that's exactly how they do it. And until that time, I've been doing it as an athlete as well, just didn't know why, but all that knowledge with the human body starts explaining why this works. In the morning, we do very light, explosive type of lifts. I'm not talking about reps and heavy squats and like explosive, very fast, like what I call it, wake up the nerve system. And when we come in the afternoon, that carries on to the sprint session. It's pretty much, I'm giving always the example to my athletes. Have you ever lifted a very heavy luggage and you reach for another one, but it's empty? What happened? You're just like flying over. And that's exactly what the nerve system does with the sprints in the afternoon. The innervation threshold decreases a lot. It fires earlier than it's supposed to be. And when you start trying to do short sprints or starts or speed boundings, it fires earlier, and it's just amazing benefit of it. To go specifically to your question, my short sprint workouts are based on what the event requirements are. So high jumpers, I don't like to put them over 30 meter sprints, because realistically their approach is 10 to 15 meters. Like, do you really need more than 30 meter sprints? I don't think so. I have very tall athletes, like, you know, very tall, like a 2 meter tall person, like, has a big difficult problem, like driving through 30 meters. He develops his peak speed probably around the 40 meters, what we're looking for, or later. This type of athletes, for a high jumper, very tall high jumper, I give him 40 meters just because of the body structure and the mechanic requirements. Horizontal jumps, we stay with 40 meters. Early in the season, I do a little bit of combinations, 30, 40, going back. And ideally, in ideal world, as you asked earlier, 40 meters is my distance. It's pretty close to the approach, horizontal approach.
Do you do these on the fly, or are you doing these from a standing start, or do you mix those up as well?
Depends on what part of the season. Early in the season, we start combinations, sometimes looking for 30 meter sled, 40 meter no sled. As I say, post-activation potentiation, activating the nerve system, and the firing is way different after that. When we're kind of like in the middle of the preparation, I stay with the pure sprints. Mix it a little bit, and once we start moving towards competition and performance time of the season, definitely the flies of 30, flies of 40. I don't really go flies. 30 meters is my choice for a flies. It's what we do, and I also do a lot of combinations in season. A little bit preseason preparation is like I do a lot of flies in the same session. I do flies, I do over speed, I do sled, finishing with sled. And again, that's going to make a lot of coaches jump out of their chair. You know, it's how are we going to build up speed if you're going with a fly? You know, over speed, okay, makes sense. But you finish with the sled. What I'm looking with that is really squeezing the endocrine system. There is a huge release of like acetylcholine, norepinephrine from the neuroconductors that helps and builds better performances for the day after and the 2 days after. So, you know, thinking about it, why are we doing sprints? To be fast, but also to help our event. And by doing this type of modalities helps what we do on the next day on the runway.
So we're leading into the next day with what we're doing in practice. And in some respects too, it's the sled then becomes like your strength training after you're running, which then most coaches would be okay with. And so like they've got to get their head out of, I have to be in the weight room to get that done. I have to do this to stimulate the endocrine system. And one of the things, coaches, that you need to understand too, is when coach is talking about lifting in the morning, how far in between the morning session and the afternoon session, how many hours are typically in between there for you?
So, you know, again, from a physiological standpoint, as long as you have about an hour and a half to 2 hours, it's plenty. Like, it's plenty of recovery for what you're looking for. And the effect lasts about, I can say about 24 hours. I can see the real effect of it. So as long as you lift like, let's say 9 o'clock in the morning or 8:30 in the morning, you know, you can come 2-3 o'clock in the afternoon and you're absolutely like perfect timing, I can say. Best post-activation potentiation researches are conducted and found that like even 15 minutes, depend what exercises you're doing, can be a very beneficial for the explosive strength after that. You know, we're not looking for that little time because our lift is a little bit more complex, a little bit more volume oriented than just like a couple half squat jumps, for example, or depth jump. Couple hours, a few hours is totally fine gap from morning to the afternoon. And another reason why I like the morning is all hormonal level in the human body in the morning are peaking naturally. When a person wakes up, the testosterone is higher, and now the estrogen in the women is higher, and you cannot replicate that any time of the day later on.
So what does that weight room session look like to take advantage of the hormonal profile that's coming in the morning? Give us a breakdown of your lifts, the reps possibly, and things that you're doing early, mid, and late season.
Okay, so Monday is very, as I say, light weightlifting session for us, activation day. At the most, in the preparation, early preparation, September, October, when we start the season, I give probably one specific weightlifting exercise that is event specific. Simple one, I'm going to give example is for long jumpers, a box step up. you know, that's a simple event specific, I can say, exercise. Not that you cannot implement it in other sports, definitely you can, but it's very close related to the takeoff and sort of speaking. You know, I give a one triple jump exercise and high jump exercise, but I'm not going more than that on Mondays. As I say, it's just activation day. A few sets, 3-4 sets of 3 to 5 reps, depends what we're doing. I'm a huge fan of a half squat jump with weights, using light weights. So I can say 70% of body weight, 70 to 80% of body weight, what athlete is, just for activation purposes. You know, we're using more weight for this exercise for different reasons, but for activation, I stay light. Again, 4 or 5 sets of 3 to 5 reps just to wake up the body. And that's about it, what we do on Monday. If I have a multi-eventer, they can do a little bit incline bench or, you know, a little bit, everybody do a little bit of core abs, but not more than that. It's been a long weekend of 2 days probably, so they have to wake up in the morning and get it ready now for the rest of the day. Otherwise, if we don't have that in the morning, I'm not going to feel comfortable put the athletes in the afternoon sprinting 100% after 2 days off. It's dangerous for the body. It's dangerous for the muscles. From 0 to 100, it can cause a lot of problems. And I experienced that in the past. Wednesdays and Fridays are our Olympic days in the weight room. I do not combine certain Olympic lifts. So I never do clean and snatch in the same session, completely two different exercises. I do not do full squat and a half squat in the same session, completely two different exercises. So in the most cases, I do power clean or clean and full squats in the early season on Wednesdays. I don't go more than 5, maximum 6 sets, maximum 6, 6 is on the long end, and 3 to 5 reps as well. What I do through the season is I change a lot of the percentages. That's what I do. Exercise, it doesn't change a lot. As I say, I like the habit creation. I like the learning the consistency of stuff. But here and there, I have new stuff just to the variety and the body functioning a little bit better. But the Olympic lifts, not much you can change it. I implement the same thing what I explained with the post-activation potentiation, not only from mornings to afternoons or day to day. I implement it from one exercise to another. So if we do a power clean, and let's say early in the season, we're around 80% or 85%, immediately after a power clean, when I say immediately, the moment the bar is still dropping on the ground and bouncing, they're on the side doing a hurdle hop or a box jump immediately. And like that, I superset Olympic lift with explosive motion or a plyometric immediately. That's another type of post-activation I'm looking in specifically in sessions. Friday, usually we do more like a snatch and a quarter squat or a half squat, I call it. Long triple joint extension motions, high as possible, work through the hips. Additional to Wednesdays, Fridays, and I do a little bit of fitness, but I'm not stressing a lot on the fitness exercises like dumbbell workouts and stuff like that. Very, very gentle with it, very little. I feel if athletes can handle, like if a male can handle 400 pounds on his back for a quarter squat or 500 or 600 pounds, doesn't matter what type of athlete is, it's strong enough, doesn't really need to do hamstring curls, like in biceps curls or stuff. Like, I stay away from this stuff. Like very little early preparation, just as, you know, introduction to the general stuff, but I stay a little bit away from fitness work. I use fitness work as a recovery day sometimes, but just to keep a variety of it. That's all.
So why, and I think I know why, but I want you to explain it and educate us, and especially for the audience. Why not snatch and clean or clean and snatch on the same day or full squat or quarter squat? What's your philosophy behind that?
Couple of different reasons. First reason is like motion is different. So with the clean, it's a little bit slower motion, a little bit not so much joint extension compared to the snatch. Doing two different stuff at the same practice is like trying to do fire and ice at the same time. It really doesn't help the athlete. It's contradicts itself. The nerve system is contradicted. So we know that with the clean, you can load the bar a little bit heavier. With loading the bar a little bit heavier, because to be at 80% or 85% at the required percentage for the period, that's going to be heavier than the snatch. And by that weight, definitely the motion is slower in terms of velocity compared to the snatch. and you're doing one slower velocity heavier with one fast velocity lighter, the body nerve system is contradicted. That's why I believe should be in different sessions. And same thing applies to the full squat and the quarter squats, for example.
Awesome. The idea that you're talking about with supersetting oftentimes is called French contrast method as well. Do you like doing that in that order because it somewhat simulates what the jumper has to do in the actual event, where they're going from big, strong motions to something more rapid and quick? Are you trying to kind of do the order of operations in that way with a, let's say you've got a, you know, a snatch followed by hurdle hops? Is that your philosophy behind that, trying to organize it in a way of what they're going to see in competition as well?
I think it's a little bit in different direction, not necessarily how the approach looks like and the takeoff looks like. Body has this, and we know that, we heard that a lot, fight or flight. I'm trying to change the fight zone. So what I'm doing with this is like the nerve cell sends impulses at certain timing. When the brain say we gotta move and you gotta flex your elbow, for example, curl your biceps, it takes a certain time to do that. By doing this contrast with the post activation, let's say clean or snatch with a hurdle hop or box hop or ankle jumps, immediately after that, it tells the body, it tricks the nerve system to start fighting, firing a little bit earlier. And what that means, how that helps in our specific events, is like when you're on the runway and when you start tricking your nerve system day after day, day after day, day, your activation, your reaction time, it's way different than if you don't do this stuff.
In competition, how do you bring these principles of the post-activation potentiation to the competition? Is there some sort of routine that you're doing on those days of competition to simulate what you traditionally your athletes are seeing in practice? How do you get them ready for that in a situation where maybe a warm-up area isn't always conducive? What type of exercises, what's your process to bring them to readiness in the warm-up on the day to facilitate what they've been doing in practice to take advantage of PAP?
Yeah, so as I say, we keep the same structure. Of course, intensities change tremendously differently through the performance, peaking performance competition season. But I always bring weights with us to competitions. So, you know, when we go to the same hotel sometimes and people in the hotel, oh, there you go, Mizura coming again with their weightlifting, you know, we're dragging bars and stands and, you know, a little, not a lot. I mean, as I say, we're not lifting heavy or anything like that. But a great example is like, if my athletes are jumping in the morning, if they're jumping competition in the morning, they do their activation lifts previous night. If they jump late in the afternoon, like 4, 5, 6 o'clock, the way it was with the girls at national championship, they did their activation lifts 8, 9 o'clock in the morning at the same day. And like that, the body is not indifferent to what it's been doing through the season. We trick the nerve system a little bit, wake up the body, and they're ready to perform in the afternoon.
Awesome, coach. So now that, by the way, fantastic. I'm furiously writing stuff down on my paper. I got so much stuff. I'm learning so much, which is excellent. So I know the audience is learning a ton as well. Talk to me now about how you handle then the days of jumping and your plyometrics on the track. Talk to me about your progression and your day-to-day for that.
You know, I'm not much familiar how most of the coaches here do it. That's why I don't want to offend anybody and make, as I say, the coaches jump out of their chair. We do not, I'm talking about horizontal jumps here. High jump is different beast. We do not jump from full approaches at practice. We never do jump from full approaches. We do full approach work, but we do not take full jumps from full approach. I like to do full complete jumps. So if it's a triple jumper, I always like first phase, second phase, third phase. For, you know, very rarely, like it's got to be somebody who has no experience with a triple jump. I took it with like probably 2, 3, 5 months of experience. Then I can break the triple jump on probably first to second phase or second. But that's for a very short period of time, because in the past, I've done that. I work a lot of partial moments in the jump, like, you know, just a swing in the long jump or just the first phase, and they get comfortable, they improve. And we forgot one thing: when we go to jump, they forgot how to do the full jump, they forgot how to do the full event. So I always like to stay with the full motion of the jump. If you have to work more on certain part of the flying mechanics or the phases, there is a different tools I'm using to highlight that area, but we always finish the jump in the sand pit. If I want to work more on the takeoff mechanics, on the angle of the takeoff with the long jump, or I might use a box with different angle, or just like a flat box or like incline box, just to change that angles, I always ask them to finish. And if it's even uncomfortable jumping with box finishing, that's fine. You gotta be a complete. Like that, the brain knows what's happening, sending the same signals every single time. And when it's time to put the whole event together, it's been every single day. It's nothing different than what we do. Early in the season, we do not step on the track at all. We stay month and a half on sand, purely on sand, like no shoes, no track, no spikes. We are bare feet on the sand entire September, mid-August, depends when the practice school season starts. And probably the beginning of October, mid-October, we shift into the track. College season is long, extremely long. Long in terms of competitions, you know, year is year. Everybody have 12 months, but in terms of competitions, it's probably the longest season in the world of track and field. I like to stay that month in the sand. It gives a tremendous base, first of all, for the healthy ankles, healthy joints, tendon work in different way, a variety of exercises that you can do on the sand with resistance from the sand. We still do our practices. We still sprint on the sand. We still bound on the sand, plyometrics, even a little bit of spin endurance on the sand, but we stay away from hard surface. At that time, our jumpings are pretty simple. We do our plyometric days, Tuesday and Thursday. We do boundings, we do different combinations. We do a lot of takeoffs, high jumpers, even horizontal jumpers, a lot of takeoffs. And as I say, they like to land it in the sand. So we're in the sand, nothing better than that. It turns very competitive with the group, like, you know, being on the sand and do that. We're blessed with conditions. We have an area here on campus. It's about 40 meters long. Couple of volleyball courts combined together, so we can run freely and you can do our exercises there. But it's a lot of plyometrics, a lot of variation of horizontal motions and vertical motions on Tuesday and Thursdays in that time. Later on in the season, when we move to the track, starting with the technicality of the event, and I like to build up the jumps from short to longer approaches. Like we start with 2-3 step jumps. And we stay about, you know, one training mesocycle. I work on mesocycles of 4 weeks. So like that 3 to 4 weeks, we do about 3 steps approaches, jumps and hammering these technicalities. And then we move to 5 or 6 steps approaches. And by December, we about what I call it half approaches now, like up to 10 to 12 steps approaches. And we never go more than horizontal jumps, more than 12 steps approach. With the high jumpers, I do the same logic. You know, started from short, moving to a little bit longer, 5 to 7 steps. By December, we on the full approach, but we start jumping with a box. We do not take full jumps approach until technically January. We spent the entire December jumping with a box. It gives another layer of preserving the legs, safety, and gives another layer that we cannot recreate in the normal jumping days. Gives you extra timing over the bar. Ideally, that's the timing you're gonna have when you're in a top performance, but now you're experiencing the fly mechanics that you can apply when you're performing your best later on in the season.
So when we're talking about doing the work off the box, you're talking about an approach, get up onto the box, jump off the box, and over the bar.
Yes.
Early. Okay.
Yes, correct. So
okay.
I use 3 different type of boxes, depends on the athlete and depends of what the needs for the athletes are. Flat box is about a 6 inches tall, and we have what is called like a ramp that creates a little bit more natural penultimate to takeoff angle for a takeoff leg, which gives a very good benefit on the technicality of the event. It hits the ground faster, if I can say it simple as that. Historically, as I say earlier, I mentioned I grew up around world record holders. I was blessed to see Stefka Kustadinova's practices. She's still a world record holder in the women's high jump with 2 meters, 9 centimeters. And she had jumps around 225, 230 with a box, which is absolutely insane. Yes. Through my career now, through experiences, I found that if athletes with a ramp can replicate good quality jumps at peak performance, it's about a 20 centimeters difference from what you can achieve with that box at practice.
That's good. That's good information. information there. That's a really nice progression. In terms of your contacts or numbers of jumps, where are you at with that? Is that something you are, I mean, obviously we're talking about number of steps and speed on the runway and partial run-ups, but with full jumps and full motion, when we're doing our off the runway, out of the sand plyometrics, what are kind of your plyometric progressions that you look at in terms of foot contacts or number of jumps?
Strictly individual, very individual. If I say a number, I'm gonna be the biggest liar, because okay. You're taking somebody, as I say, I really have athletes on my group and absolutely amazing athletes, like with 6 months of experience in jumps. And I have athletes that they've been doing it like last 6 years. And I cannot put a specific number on these two different type of athletes. The volume is always based on what athlete can handle, what the goals for the season are, and of course, last but not least, health requirements. How the athletes feel at the day, how much they can handle. I'm gonna say this to be a little bit more specific. I'm very low on volumes, very low. When we're in volume season, September, October, if I can pull 6 to 10 jump in the best case scenario, I'm happy with it. You know, that depends on how many steps we are on the approach. But I never ask any of my jumpers to take more than 10 attempts on the horizontal jumps. In the high jump, it's a little bit different beast. I've been going to, with the experienced athletes, with the higher level athletes that I know they're chasing like world level performances, I've been going anywhere between 30 and 40 attempts per, but that's, I'm talking about very high level, very experienced athletes, between 20 and 40 attempts from short approaches, high jump. And on the end, what I'm looking for in practice like that, quality is absolutely not good on the end. Like, I'm not going to lie, like, you know, you've seen somebody like a male that can jump over 7 foot, and then the end they'll jump in a bit like 5'11", 6 foot at the session. I'm not looking for the performance. I'm looking for the quality of execution, even the bodies of at 6 foot. I'm looking for the mental creation of like, I can handle that, because I've seen competitions with people clear it from third attempt at high jump. And if you have about 6 bars by third attempt, that's 18 jumps. And I've seen on top of that a jump off on the end. So, you know, at very tough scenario, you gotta be able to handle about 20 jumps. We don't want that to happen at competition, but it's possible. It's possible. Yeah, I stay on the low end of the volume. Horizontal jumpers, no more than 10 jumps per practice.
And again, is that to kind of build itself around the specific requirements of the competition? If you make it through prelims, you get your extended, you know, you get your additional jumps, and then maybe, you know, you've got your run-throughs and pop-offs that you're going to have as well in a particular meet. Is that why you kind of fit that in terms of your range?
Correct. As you described it, prelims and finals, I have another type of practices I do. You know, athletes that I know they're going to have this type of competition, they're going to jump 1 day prelims, and 2 days later they have final. And if you remember, I say I do my jumps Tuesday and Thursday. That's exactly the same scenario. You jump, you have a day in between, and you jump again. That's already built up in that that expectation. But the other thing I do is when I know this athlete is going to have this, let's say Olympic trials or, you know, international meets, we do specific work like that. We do 3 or 4 jumps the first day, because that's what the prelims are. You have only 3 attempts. And at that time, they're already in peak performance. They're ready to do stuff. And 3 jumps from short approach is like exactly 100% effort, 100% from the short approach, 100% like focus in the jumps. And 1 day off or easy practice, whatever we have for the modalities. And the second jump session, I can give him a little bit more like 5 to 6 jumps to replicate that environment. But yes, you're right. At the most, you have 6 jumps and plus a couple warm-up jumps. That's about 9 to 10 jumps at the whole competition day. And I build the approaches same way. We do about 8-9 approaches per session. Full approaches, just the takeoff or just first phase to replicate that. About 2 to 3 approaches before the competition starts, and you have 6 jumps. So that's 9-10 jumps total.
Awesome. That's great. That's great information. So you mentioned coaching people that are learning to jump and they might have only been doing it for 6 months. And in my mind, I'm seeing you coaching like this person who's supposed to be a decathlete or something, and they've never jumped in their life, and you're now trying to teach them how to high jump or to long jump and all this. And I'm just like, oh my gosh, you know, how much of a struggle could that possibly be? So my question for you is, what's the most difficult aspect of jump training or coaching the jumps that you've found when you're trying to teach those new athletes in the jumps? What's this real barrier you find that athletes have a hard time with? And then what have you done to deal with that or fix that for them?
You know, once in a while you have one of these superstars that never done something, you show it to them once or twice, and it's like, wow, why not everyone is like that? But the reality is not everyone is like that. That I'm going back to the beginning of our conversation, that building the foundation for the athletes is very important. You know, if athletes know how to skip in all directions, if they know how to do proper sprint drills, if they know how to move proper in the space in general, they will learn easier new stuff. When I struggle with athletes like that, they never done it and it takes them a little bit longer to get comfortable, I really, really have to remind myself, just be patient, because as a coach, it's our expectations. It's got to happen now. You got to make it happen. You got to look good every day. And that's not the case. Just have to remind myself, like, take your time. You know, it's going to happen. Remind the athlete, take your time. It's going to happen. And make him feel comfortable. That's the key. If athlete doesn't feel comfortable and confident in what we do, it's a lost cause. It's totally a lost cause.
So one of the things I found, and it's becoming a bigger and bigger problem, I mean, we've mentioned earlier about the PE testing, and I mean, what we're finding, just a peek behind the curtain at the high school level in Missouri and in my particular area, is that athletes are coming in less and less fit, and they have less and less athletic background. And especially because of the coronavirus, one of the things that now we've gotten into the regular track and field season in St. Louis for high schoolers, we've got a lot of soreness and injuries and things like that, that we've never had before, you know? So we've had to radically adjust. And I found it very frustrating. Like you mentioned, skipping. Kids don't know how to skip. Like genuinely don't know how to skip. It's like, they're like the worst dancers I've ever seen. You know, they just can't move. They don't know how to bound. They're like, is this what bounding is? I'm like, no, that's sprinting. And yes, sprinting is plyometric, but you're supposed to be jumping from one foot to the other foot. And I mean, gosh, it is, but it's incredible to see how like unbelievably discoordinated those people are. So what are some things that you've done to try to get them ready for that? If you see some of those goofy movement patterns or things that they haven't done correctly, how have you retaught them to move in the right way?
No. Society requires a lot of stuff these days, like distractions a lot. I think you're right. That's why they don't know how to skip and bounce and, you know, the general stuff, because they play PlayStation, you know, they watch TV, they have a social media in their hands all the time. I mean, this distraction is a lot. You know, your generation, my generation, we didn't have that many distractions. So what we do is like, that's our entertainment, climb a tree, jump over a paddle, you know, stuff like that. And we don't see that now with kids. Kids don't play outside. You know, I live in a neighborhood that it's so many kids, young kids, and I don't see the kids outside, and it's sad. But, you know, I start in this scenario with a very deep conversation. Do not expect me to put you in the pit or in the specific event until we learn how to do the stuff. And typical questions, yeah, but Jim and Jilly are doing this. Why I'm not doing this? They are doing it because they've been doing it 6 years already. You haven't done it even 6 weeks. So deep conversations about it, make them understand why I'm going to back up a lot with the foundations. And then hopefully they really trust that and believe that that's the needed environment for them. And by what I'm saying, and we start with a lot of drills. When I say drills, I'm not even talking about like jumping drills. I'm speaking about sprint drills. Just drills, like after drills. And the track and field necessities through a warm-up, through mechanical requirements. And we do that a lot. I had athletes in the past spend entire semesters doing stuff like that. Here and there, play a little bit with the event, but really our goal is like to teach the athlete what it takes to be the athlete. And improvements come after that. But it's not comfortable because everybody coming in college or even in high school, they want to be the best. They want to be good. They want to go to the state championship or national championship. And they want to happen now. That's our society's fast internet, fast food, everything got to be fast. And we cannot trick the human body in the evolution. Even though we do a lot of change in the evolution of performances, we cannot accelerate the process as much as we want. So they have to trust that they need to learn the foundations and then move to what they need to do. I have a great example with that. My female triple jumper that finished 8th at the national championship, she had probably 3 months or 4 months experience of triple jump, very little, before she came with me. And last year, you know, we had the pandemic for the outdoor season, but the whole indoor season, she was doing probably every practice different than what the triple jumpers are doing. And different, not complicated different, like simple different, like high knee sprint drills, that's how you move, that's what you do. Okay, let's take 3 jumps. That's it for today. That's it for today. And very, very much work on basics. And again, we lost a lot of time with the COVID, which is same for everybody. We came the beginning of the year and she was performing mechanically the way I wanted to, you know, close to what I wanted to. So I was able to equalize her with the rest of the group. And the thing started taking off from there, but we really spent like her first year completely like learning the basics.
That's awesome, coach. So when we're talking about kind of having some of these athletes who've never done this stuff before or don't know how to move and all these kind of things, what do you think coaches get wrong about jump training or jump methods? And what would you rather see them do than the common mistakes that they make?
I don't want to put everybody in the same bucket, but you know, if I can generally speak about it, it's less running, more drills. And when I say drills, not drills in the sand, drills out of the sand, on the grass. Like, as I say earlier, sprint drills, 1, 2, 3, pop up, 1, 2, 3, pop, that type of stuff. Long jump imitations, triple jump walks. You walk with the triple jump motions. So, you know, you can remember this stuff. But again, going back to foundations, sprint drills, sprint drills, sprint drills. I have a great example that I already like going that direction. And by seeing that with my own eyes, it just gave me so much reassurance and confidence. We were at the Olympic Training Center. And I saw Tyson Gay doing sprint drills with all the group, not only him, the whole group, probably for about 50 minutes. And the coach was, no, again, no, again, no, again. You know, I'm not saying that happened all the time. I'm sure it doesn't happen all the time. But the moment I witnessed that, it was remarkable. Like, he's the guy. He's the guy who runs fastest sprint possibly, like, you know, you can imagine. And they had to relearn the stuff that day. And the end of the practice, they went on the curve and did 2 or 3 block starts, and that was the whole session. And that's April. That's pretty much moving towards competition season. So basics are not only basics for the newbies, basics are important for everybody.
Yeah, and with Tyson Gay specifically, like, he was so fast, but you know, one of the things that was dangerous for him is even though he was that fast and that talented, I would argue as a sprint guy that he didn't move very well and probably needed that almost like a vaccine for him to inoculate himself from injury. And I would, let's not forget, he did get hurt where he wasn't able to meet up with Usain in 08 for them to have that big, you know, rivalry, which was looking to be probably the best possible sprint opportunity we've ever had head to head. Now, obviously in Berlin the next year, they did do that. And then Tyson was able to push Usain to a world record that probably nobody ever thought was possible, you know, and this idea that these experts and the best in the world, you know, they just do all these things well and don't need any interventions is completely false. Like, they need that regular dose and prescriptions of movements, just like you're saying, to be able to, because the thing is like, you might get good at something, or, you know, you're overloading a particular thing here, and then that makes a bio change somewhere else or in the movement patterns. And it's important for us as coaches to say, okay, you know, hey, you can do this really well. We've made this change, but because this change is happening, we've maybe ignored this. And so this is why we've constantly got to be doing these things to keep you in what I would say is these guardrails of movement, you know, to keep you healthy and to keep you safe. So speaking of things that coaches don't necessarily do right in a general sense, for you in particular, what is something that you used to really value as a coach that you no longer find to be that important in your methods, your training, and your ideology?
You know, once I use a tool, modality in the practice, I don't like completely to throw it away. You know, I might put it in a toolbox and like might use it in 2 years forward, because everybody are different. They need different approach. But probably the thing that I change a lot is like rehab. What I say rehab is like early years of my coaching career, like I like to train like pretty much study Monday through Friday. Like, you know, we work hard every day. Still not long practices, but it's hard every day. So past few years, like, you know, I had to change stuff because I started working with high level athletes, and high level athletes have are more predisposed to injuries. You know, they create a lot of forces that, you know, high school not necessarily creates. And I had to find ways how I'm keeping that person very healthy, first of all, to be able to practice week after week. And not only practice week after week, but the practices to be at high quality level. And I start implementing like a lot of active recovery days, rehab exercises. And that's something that started changing recently in my career. It works. I'm happy that I did that. You know, it pays off. We are able to handle more and more high quality individual sessions. And they stay healthy. And not only that, but they're capable of competing longer through the season. Their season prolongs longer and they stay longer in a peak performance than I had in the past.
So where do we place those days? Are we placing those on Wednesdays, Saturdays, Sundays? Where does that usually fit into your session?
Depends on the people again. Depends on what how they look like. You gotta like carefully like look the person. Have to have the eye to see if they start overtraining a little bit and change the stuff, you know, changing the volumes. I typically place it like between the 2 days, Tuesday and Thursday jumping sessions, if that allows it, you know. But as I say, it's individual. In a perfect world, if everything goes well, I will have like a recovery type of workout on Wednesday before between the jump sessions. We're still gonna lift in the morning, but afternoon might be some easy strides or med balls or like a very gentle fitness workout, hurdle mobility, that type of stuff. And if you go previous conversation, people sometimes have prelims and finals. And in between, you cannot really practice a lot. You can activate, shake out a little bit. And that's exactly what I'm looking for as well in the modalities. If we have a six day training schedule, I do that on Thursday and we jump on Friday.
Awesome. So talk to us a little bit about when we talk about technique and technical aspects. One of the hardest things for jumpers to do is to steer properly towards the board or to the bar in the high jump. How do you help those athletes manage getting to the board in a timely fashion with confidence in the positions you want them to do? How do you build that?
I don't start approach work until late. Again, that's probably controversial of what a lot of coaches saying. They like, you got to start approaches as soon as possible. Nothing wrong with it. Builds confidence to the athletes. The issue I have with that is when you run, you know, we start sprinting as soon as possible for sure. And when you run, let's say, a full 40 meters sprint in September or October, you know, you run it certain time. And when you run the same run in January, when you're already prepared to compete, you probably 0.2, 0.3, if not faster than what you were in September. So you're doing approach work in September with you still full going sprinting, you feel comfortable, but your times are X amount of times, and you run way faster in January, the rhythm is not same. So I found that it creates more inconsistency than actually creates consistency starting that early with the approaches. Builds confidence, but the inconsistency is bigger and takes me longer time to clean that through the competition season. So what I do is I start with a lot of different stuff out of the jumping pit in terms of approaches. We do cone runs, like I put the cones on specific distances that creates approach type of rhythm, and we sprint that. We do different type of sprints, like in out, like stuff like that, changing the intensity of the sprint because athletes getting comfortable to control their speed. In any mean, I don't want them to start controlling speed before the board, but it creates some sort of coordination for it. Actual approach work, we start late December, early January. Like that, I know their speed, pure speed, it's exactly where pretty much is going to be the whole competition season at that time. And it's really, I know their optimal efforts on the runway is going to be the same optimal efforts when they are competition, and it's gonna be present. Early in our competition season, yeah, we do a lot of fouls. I'm not going to lie about it. And I'm asking my athletes all the time, just trust it, run it. I'm going to fix you. I'm going to move it back and forward. You always run your run. You always do your approaches. And I have athletes that start pretty much the season in the beginning with 4 or 5 fouls per competition. And I'm not scared at all because reality is like, yeah, we might miss a good quality jump here and there. But once we go to the national championship, conference championship, and the important competitions, we have none or probably 1 foul out of 6. So we are not any worse than anybody else. But that buildup creates, I'm not worried about a board. I'm just running and do me. Coach is going to move me and tell me how to fix my approach. It creates a little bit more consistency once it's done. It's later on, you know, right before where we have to peak. But when it's created, it lasts a whole year after that.
I love that philosophy, and that makes a lot of sense. It's like, well, you're not at this velocity at this point, and we're going to teach you approach for the velocity that you're not going to have later. Why don't we wait and build all these other properties and biomotor abilities? And then when we come to the most important technical aspect possibly of the jump is kind of getting on the board and the approach and all that kind of stuff. Now we know how to control that speed, and now we're running at the speed in which we're going to be hitting in competition. That makes so much common sense. And I've not heard that explained that way before. So that's a very unique perspective. Speaking of unique perspectives, and coach, I only got this question and one more. We really appreciate you spending all this time with our audience and everything. And it's been very informative and I've learned a lot. But teach us one unique drill that maybe you've developed in your arsenal or something you like to do that maybe a lot of other coaches don't do. And talk about where you put that in your training.
No, like, I feel like there is no lot of secrets in track and field. Like, I know a lot of coaches are looking for that specific thing that's going to change everything in their training. And it's really nothing that is specific. Everybody has to develop speed. Everybody got to get strong, explosive, you know, and technical. These are the four main stuff I'm looking into preparation program, speed, strength, explosive strength, and technique. And if you look on these four things, like the four legs of the table, if one of these things is short, the plot is going to be always wiggly, never going to be a full level of performance. And think about when I say speed, like, again, I gave example with the 40 meters, that's pure speed for me. Pure strength is like, you know, how strong in the weight room. Explosive strength is how you carry that weight room on the track, like, you know, through plow metrics, for example. And technique is technique. You know, you gotta take a jumping amount of exercises, like, or actual jumps. More you do it, better you're gonna become. And growing these four things together is what I think is the important key here. You know, if you're a little bit stronger than you, fast and explosive, probably you gotta slow down in the weight room and concentrate on the other stuff. I'm not saying don't lift, but try to equalize your qualities. If you got to speak specifically for jumps, something that everybody has to do, I think everybody got to learn how to bounce, you know, from younger age. I'm not speaking about competitive bowling in seventh graders or something like that, but once you're in high school, you have to have a general knowledge of plyometrics and bounding. So really like bounding left to right, alternate boundings or single leg hop stuff, it's very important for jumpers. And that fits all jumps, like long, triple, high. That's something that I really want to recommend and say that fits everybody under the same line, yeah.
Awesome. So last question for you. What do you think separates you from other coaches in your field right now in the jumps? I mean, you are racking up a large number of All-Americans. You're making quite a name for yourself. You've been successful for obviously a long time, even before you got to Mizzou. But what do you think it is that really has kind of put you in a position where your jumpers are jumping really well when they need to, and a lot of them in a lot of different events are having success?
Thank you for that. I really appreciate. I never can like satisfy myself how my athletes are performing. I always like, hey, that was okay, but we got to do better. So they know what the conversation is. Doesn't matter how good they're going to jump with PRs. They always know what the conversation is going to be, that we got to do better. But what makes me different? I think it's really like the time I spent in my education in knowing the human body. Like 4 years in the physical therapy, another 4 years in athletic training, and another 2 years in the human performance. Total of 10 years, like I was digging so deep and at the same time coaching. And I was asking myself, why this exercise is good? What it makes difference? Yeah, everybody sprint, everybody jump, but how we combine the stuff and how that works physiologically, neurologically, you know, how biomechanically works. And I think the amount of time I spent with that, it's not everyone had the opportunity to do that. And that's why I'm a little bit different probably of everybody else. I'm not giving exercises or modality just because we have to do that, but really what the purpose is of in terms of physiology of the body and how that's going to change your body, not only for the session, but in the next day and the next week.
Well, Coach, I appreciate it. And obviously your education is paying a lot of dividends for a lot of people, and you're providing many, many great collegiate athletes an opportunity to reach their dreams, and not just in the States, but athletes from around the world, because I know you have a global network of athletes that you're bringing in and helping a lot of athletes in maybe certain countries that, you know, I don't know, I can't speak for everybody, but I don't know that they have somebody like you there. And so you being here and being able to bring all of these people in and grabbing all of these different jumpers and bringing them to such an elite level has been really fun to see and exciting to watch. And as a fan of Mizzou track and field and a big supporter of it, I'm really proud to see my flagship university in my state have so much success. And a lot of that is the through line of your work and your training and your mentorship. So Coach, is there anywhere that people can follow you or catch up with you on social media, anything like that, if they had any additional questions? Because I know you gave us a lot of stuff, and I'm sure that, you know, if I had 5 hours with you, we'd go down some rabbit holes, but I don't want to take up all of your time. But where can people reach out to you or connect with you?
Yeah, I don't say I'm heavy on social media. Definitely I'm not compared to the teenagers around, but I have accounts and I'm easy to access through these accounts. I have a Facebook and an Instagram. My Twitter is active again. It's my name, just the way it's spelled, my name, you know, can be found on our website. It's same account I have on the three social medias, and I'm easy to find there. I'm checking regularly my social media, so I'm going to be able to respond to any questions people have, and I'll be happy to do that.
Awesome, Coach. Well, thank you. And for those of us that are listening today, you know, make sure that you remember to subscribe to the Companions of the Compendium podcast. Share this out. Get this message out. There's a lot of value and information here, and Coach is doing such a great job. And we need these conversations to get out to a lot of coaches so that we have people that know how to bound when they get into college and they know how to move right, just like Coach said, and get our athletes to reach some peaks and some break some world records and things that we need them to do. Because the reality is like he said, it isn't magic. It's hard work. It's technical know-how, it's the mentorship and management of the numbers. All of those things are very valuable. So to my listeners, remember, be smart, be safe, make good decisions, and M-I-Z-Z-O-U. See you later, Coach.
Thank you.